Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, we're so glad that you came out this evening and that it's not snowing buckets to welcome John Thavis with his new book, Vatican Diaries. John is a journalist, a writer, was at one time an archaeology student and classical languages, and he's now a Vaticanista. That's my new word. Okay. John grew up in Minnesota attending Catholic schools and graduating from St. John's University in 1973. Then he took off as an archaeology student to Italy in 1977, fell in love with the country, and decided to stay. In 1978, he walked into the offices of the Rome Daily American, where he was hired as a headline writer and then an editor. That year, he had lots of headlines to write. The prime minister was abducted, and there were two papal conclaves in one year. He returned to Minnesota in 1979, where he worked as a reporter at a daily paper, a daily local paper, in his hometown. It wasn't long before he convinced his wife to return to Italy. They remained there for 30 years, where they raised two sons and a daughter. Now they're back in the United States, except for his daughter, who's a blues singer in Rome, which is pretty awesome. Okay. So all the in-betweens, a lot of that we're going to hear about tonight. So let's get started and welcome him.
Great. Thank you. I very frequently I'm asked, why did you move back from Italy? What was wrong with Italy? Well, nothing's really wrong with it, but after you're there for 30 years, the love affair kind of wears off a bit, and you start seeing some of the things that don't work. And I honestly tell people I'm happy to be back in a country where things work, where you can cross the street without fearing for your life, where you can pay a bill without taking hours, where if you pay taxes, you don't feel like a complete idiot. And so it's great to be back in this country. And I've been back here now for almost a year and a half. I retired from my job at Catholic News Service. And about 2 months ago, I decided I needed to go back to Rome, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Because that was a very exciting time. It's an exciting moment for the Catholic Church. We have a pope, a new pope, who seems intent on doing things very differently. We had a pope who resigned for the first time in 600 years, and I was fortunate enough to be in Rome for this series of historic events. I covered the Vatican for 30 years, okay? And after I moved back to Minnesota, I finished my book. I had this coming out, and, you know, I sold the book about a year ago. From that time on, I started thinking, what if the Pope resigns or dies? For purely selfish reasons, I thought, this could disrupt the publication of my book. I might have to go back and revise it. So I started keeping very close track of what was on Pope Benedict's schedule. And along about last fall, I started thinking, wow, he's finished his book, his last book on Jesus of Nazareth. He's winding up a synod of bishops now on the new evangelization project, his kind of legacy project. He had just completed this series of ad limina bishops with all the bishops around the world. It took him 8 years to do that. And he really did not have much on his calendar. And then he named six cardinals in November. This, to me, sent up a red flag. I said, he already named cardinals earlier in the year. It seems to me like he's topping up for a conclave. So I emailed my friends in Rome, my journalist friends. I said, what do you think? It seems to me like he could be getting ready to resign. And I got back answers like, I don't know. I don't think so. It looks okay. And it was literally a case of where being further away, you could actually see more. Because when you're there and the Pope is making more or less daily appearances and going through the same routine, you try to block that out, these kind of apocalyptic possibilities of suddenly he'll one day walk in and resign. Well, I decided that the Pope was going to resign on February 22nd. Why did I decide that? Because I had this date in my mind for years. I thought, this is the feast of the chair of Peter. And throughout history, this is a feast that's tied to the authority of the papacy. And popes have done very important things on that date, issued very important documents. And I thought, if he's going to resign, that's the day he's going to do it. So I decided, I'll be in Rome for that day. And I flew to Rome on February 10th, in part to touch base with my Vatican sources. I had this book coming out February 21st, and I needed to get back in contact with all things Vatican. I arrived February 10th, and the next morning I walked into the Vatican press office to hear that Pope Benedict had just announced his resignation. Well, my journalist colleagues looked at me, saw me for the first time in a year, were very suspicious, and said, "What are you doing here? You knew." And I keep telling him, I did not know, but I had this suspicion, this nagging suspicion, and sure enough, there he did. He resigned. And when it actually happened, I was as shocked as everyone because, of course, to talk about resignation as a hypothesis is one thing. When you have the Pope actually saying, I'm gone in 2 weeks, it is shocking. It hasn't happened before. Then the cardinals came to Rome. I prolonged my visit, obviously. This is what I live for, these kinds of events. And the conclave was coming up. And I was back being a Vaticanista again. And now I had the book coming out, so it was the perfect storm as far as my publisher was concerned. They thought I convinced the Pope to resign in order to increase sales of my book. And I truly did not. When the cardinals came to Rome for the conclave, there was an interesting dynamic at work. I had not seen this before in my 30 years, but they were very critical. Many of them saw Benedict as a victim of an inept and at times corrupt Vatican bureaucracy, and they were openly critical of the Roman Curia. The cardinals held daily meetings, and Curia officials were marched up to the microphone and asked some very tough questions. And at one point during these meetings, Cardinal Jorge Maria Bergoglio of Argentina stood up, and he expressed a new vision of the Church, one that he said is less self-referencing. As he put it, a Church willing to go to where the people actually live, a Church less focused on its own theology and more on the real world, a Church that not only talks about the poor but lives in solidarity with the poor. And a Church, he said, that is willing to reduce this bureaucratic barrier that is represented by Vatican offices. Well, a significant number of these cardinals liked what they heard from Bergoglio. And I have to be careful here because I sound like I'm bragging. I'm not really bragging. I don't want to say I called this papal election, okay? Because like everyone, I was a little in the dark, but 2 days before the voting began, my sources told me Cardinal Bergoglio, his star is rising. He made a great impression. There are a number of cardinals talking about him as Pope. I was surprised because the man is 76 years old. He had already been passed over, so to speak, in 2005. The word was that he had gotten a significant number of votes but had not been elected. So, nevertheless, I decided, okay, I wrote it on my blog. I singled him out as a papal candidate. I said, don't forget this man. His star is rising. So, yes, I called it. And when the white smoke rose from the Sistine Chapel, I was doing live commentary for ABC News, and people were pretty much scrambling for things to say about a name that was not familiar to them. He was at the top of my cheat sheet, and I was able to jump in and be a pundit. In short, the cardinals came to Rome, they applauded Bergoglio, they elected him pope, and then they went home. And they left him to navigate a world he really does not know well. He is an outsider. My book explains what Pope Francis should expect, what his battlefield will be if he really wants to reform the Vatican. And I think my book also explains why Benedict resigned and why he felt so frustrated at the series of missteps, leaks, and power struggles that took place in his own backyard during his 8 years. Why write a book? That was the question I asked myself for many, many years. But when I retired, I said, I need to write a book because I was convinced that the public perception of the Vatican was a caricature. You know, typically the Vatican is viewed as this monolithic power structure where the orders come down from on high and are carried out in lockstep. Hermetically sealed, of course. No secrets can get out. This was not the Vatican I knew. And I kept telling people, it doesn't really work like that. Well, I decided to write a book. The Vatican I knew was a place where the cardinals of the Roman Curia would speak out of turn quite often, where leaks were actually quite common, and where the right hand often didn't know what the left hand was doing. It's much more decentralized than people imagine. It's a place where lower-level officials have a great degree of freedom to operate and therefore to make mistakes. These bit players often take center stage. And a lot of my chapters are about big, important people, but a lot of them are also about these smaller officials who nevertheless have had a great impact on what happens at the Vatican. So that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to convey the humanness of the place in ways, humanness and fallibility. You know, humans are fallible. They do make mistakes. But also some of the good things that are being done by Vatican officials. And there are many Vatican officials who are working to improve transparency, to make the place more responsive to the modern world. In fact, part of this backstage reality, a big part, is that there is a strong tension right now between forces that are favoring transparency and forces that are trying to preserve secrecy. You know, you have the demands of modern communication on the one hand, but centuries of confidentiality on the other. The Vatican is used to doing things behind its walls, which are 17 feet thick, after all. So you see contradictions. You see, we saw it every day. You know, a pope who's on Twitter and yet who writes out his own documents longhand. He doesn't really ever go on the computer. Or a pope who gives a press conference on his airplane to journalists, says some very interesting things, which are reported. Meanwhile, back at the Vatican, a lower-level official is busy reworking and revising his actual words for the official record, because they still think that until it's published in the Acta Apostolicae Sedis, which is the Vatican's version of the congressional record, that it doesn't really matter. Or the Vatican launches social media projects, which they have done, you know, to their credit. But they're not really interactive because the Vatican doesn't want to read comments yet. They're afraid of comments. And, you know, the Vatican has spoken in a monologue pretty much for several hundred years. And it's very hard to adapt to the idea that suddenly you're going to have to read criticism online. My final example of this is Pope Benedict, who announced he was taking this revolutionary step of resigning the papacy, which I think required great humility and a great sense of what the modern world requires. But he makes this announcement in Latin so that half the cardinals in the room did not understand what he was saying because they don't speak Latin anymore. In terms of organizational efficiency, the Vatican is pretty dysfunctional, but it is fascinating. And that's part of the problem for me as a journalist and as an author. For me, it's much more interesting to cover a Vatican where secrets cannot be kept and where cardinals are too candid than a Vatican that runs like a machine. And so I wish Pope Francis well in his efforts to reform the Vatican, but in a way, I hope he's not completely successful because you know, the way journalists get information is often through these episodes where people aren't supposed to talk but do. The last chapter of my book, I'm going to read a couple of things from the book, two or three things, and then take your questions and then sign your copies if you'd like me to. The last chapter of my book profiles the real Benedict. That's what I call him. Benedict was hard for journalists to figure out. And it describes Benedict a year or two ago as looking a lot like Charlie Brown, convinced that he could not really win in this world, but plugging away nonetheless. You know, he had that air about him. It seemed like someone was always pulling up the football at the last second. You know, if you've read Charlie Brown, you know what I mean. And often that someone was a Vatican official. And I do offer examples in my book. One came in 2010, when new revelations of sex abuse had prompted criticism of Pope Benedict. Now, the Pope, as a cardinal, had access to some of the files of the accused priests. Vatican officials thought this reporting was tremendously unfair, and they tried to rally round the Pope, of course, in a way that backfired. I write here about a man who was known as Preacher of the Papal Household. He's a Capuchin friar named Raniero Cantalamessa. And his sermons were always very interesting. He would skip thematically from the Old Testament to pop music to whatever he happened to see on TV the night before. So he was fun to cover. It was Good Friday. The Pope and the Roman Curia were in St. Peter's Basilica, and Cantalamessa suggested that the Catholic Church was being unfairly attacked and that Jews, who know from experience what it means to be victims of collective violence, should sympathize. As Benedict and his aides sat expressionless next to the altar of St. Peter's, Cantalamessa then read a letter from a Jewish friend who said the current criticism of the Pope and other church leaders reminded him of the most shameful aspects of anti-Semitism. With that phrase, the Holocaust alarm bells went off in newsrooms everywhere. The papal preacher seemed to be comparing the programmed extermination of 6 million Jews who were innocent victims of a racist ideology to some bad press endured by Catholic church leaders who had, at least in some cases, actually covered up sexual abuse by priests. No sooner had the Pope processed out of St. Peter's than Jewish groups around the world were protesting, and many Catholics were shaking their heads in disbelief. Pope Benedict, however, had been as blindsided by the Good Friday sermon as everyone else. Strangely, unbelievably to outsiders, the papal preacher had neglected to submit his text to anyone at the Vatican before pronouncing it to the Pope and to the world. Cantalamessa explained that no one had ever looked at his sermons ahead of time. Essentially, he had an open mic every time he spoke. And this is what I mean by lower-level people at the Vatican suddenly taking center stage. And I'm not sure that his talks still have any kind of prior review, which may seem strange. The media, you know, my book is not too easy on the Vatican. I think it's as honest as I could be. It's not too easy on the media either, because frankly, I think the media doesn't do a great job covering the Vatican. It often misreads the Vatican. Usually it conflates events. It reads too much into a line that may appear in the Vatican newspaper or take a statement by some lower level Monsignor as the Vatican says. It hunts for sound bites in encyclicals. It sees a grand design wherever some error is made, and the grand design is usually not there. I want to read from my chapter titled Latinist. It is a profile of Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who was my own Latin teacher and who worked as a translator in the Vatican's Latin letters section. Father Foster is an old friend, and my book, I hope he liked the book. I haven't talked to him lately. Because I quote him extensively, and some of the things he says are pretty shocking. But then again, he used to say them in a very loud voice while walking down the halls of the Vatican about 20 feet from the papal apartments. His job was to translate Vatican documents, including encyclicals, and he would often think that they were just too wordy. And the way he would phrase that is, "What a load of crap! do you need 180 words on God is love? You know, something like that. 180 pages. I'm sorry." So here's what I wrote, and this is more about the media than Father Foster. The morning after he was elected, Pope Benedict celebrated Mass in the Sistine Chapel to officially end the conclave. It was the world's first look at the new pontiff, and at the end of the long liturgy, he took his seat on a beige throne and delivered a 5-page sermon. In the Vatican press office, reporters looked at each other in disbelief. The Pope was speaking in Latin instead of the usual Italian. Surely this was a sign of something. As we scrutinized the Italian translation handed out at the press office, murmurs filled the room at the surprising content. Pope Benedict was announcing that the Second Vatican Council would remain the compass for the Church under his pontificate. His goal, he said, would be to build an open and sincere dialogue with everyone. He stressed his commitment to ecumenism and bridge building with other religions, as well as to the Church's efforts to promote justice and peace in the world. Pope Benedict, the Church's doctrinal watchdog and conservative theologian par excellence, was taking a liberal stance in his first major address as Pope. It made for a good storyline, and we all wrote articles suggesting that right at the outset, Benedict had signaled that his papacy would not be boxed in by the expectations of traditionalists. Indeed, by outlining such a progressive agenda in Latin, perhaps the new pope was sending a subtle message to the Church's most conservative wing. I speak your language, but I don't share your mindset. Sometime later, when I mentioned to Father Foster the importance of the Pope's inaugural sermon, he guffawed. Are you kidding? That was just a can thing. We wrote it a week before the conclave, he said. What do you mean, I asked. They needed something to hand the new pope, something all-purpose, got it? We had him say something about everything. It was generic. Vatican II was great, a bit about war and peace, something nice about young people, ecumenism, the whole bag. He paused and then snorted. Don't tell me you people thought this man was elected pope one evening and pulls out a 5-page homily in Latin the next morning? Come on. I went back and reread the sermon. Sure enough, except for a few introductory lines, it was Vatican boilerplate. Surprisingly well-assembled boilerplate, though. As for the significance of the Pope's delivering his first sermon in Latin, Foster pointed out that it had always been done that way. He was right about that, too, of course. It had been a long time between popes, and reporters had simply forgotten. So that's so much for the press, right? And I include myself in that group. Again, the temptation of reading too much into small things is huge when you're covering the Vatican. The process of declaring someone a saint is something I examine in my book with the Sainthood Cause of Pius XII. It relies to a great degree on people willing to push the cause. So yes, it is political. In the case of Pope Pius XII, I discovered that one of the prime movers behind the scenes was an American nun who from time to time would come to Rome and try to light a fire under Vatican officials. Here's what I wrote. The voice at the other end of the phone was gravelly, with a thick New Jersey accent. She was selling a story, something about a book she'd written on Pius XII. I'd never met her, but she was about to correct that. You better come see me, dear. This is going to be big. It was 2003, and with the debate over Pius and the Holocaust reaching a crescendo, It seemed like a good story. I did go to see her at the convent near the Vatican where she was staying, a house of the religious teachers Filippini, an order founded more than 300 years ago. Sister Margherita Marchione, 82 years old, but you'd never guess it, came into the foyer not with one book, but with a stack of various volumes, and slapped them down on the table. "There you go, darling. You've got plenty to write about now." She stood about 5 feet tall and wore the dark habit of her order, a black shawl-like affair, that she tugged at as she sat down in front of me. Her graying hair was visible under a soft black bonnet, and a pair of oversized glasses made her eyes look like cannons ready to fire. She wore a continuous smile that seemed genuine. "We've got to get Pius XII beatified, Johnny," she declared. "The man was a saint." Johnny? I hadn't been called that since fifth grade. And in fact, there was something about this scene that reminded me of my parochial school education. Picking a slim, hardcover book from the pile, she continued, "This is my latest. I had to write it with the smear campaign going on against this good man. I gave a copy to the Pope the other day." It was titled simply Pope Pius XII, and it laid out the case that the late pontiff had prudently and quietly helped the Jews, opposed Hitler at every turn, and practiced the virtues of a saint. "Do you have children? They'll love this," she said, pulling out a copy of Pius XII, the Children's Pope. A biography in easy-to-color line drawings, along with a brief narrative. I turned to a page titled The Holocaust and read, "In Germany, Adolf Hitler killed thousands of Jewish people and others. The Pope saved many by hiding them in the Vatican and in convents and monasteries. He also provided them with money, food, and clothing." Another page recalled how Pius once found an injured bird in the Vatican gardens and nursed it back to health. It would perch on his shoulder during mealtimes, hopping down to eat from its own dish of seeds and keeping him company. "It's all true," Sister Margherita said, looking over my shoulder. "People forget what a beautiful human being this man was. How many children do you have? Three? Take one for each of them, dear." Sister Margherita called herself, she still calls herself, the fighting nun. She's still waiting for Pius XII to be beatified. She is not, however, simply a partisan supporter. She's a historian who wrote what turned out to be a very important book, researching the actual convents and monasteries in Rome where Jews were hidden during World War II. And she's the only scholar who bothered to do this and who had the access to be able to do it. So she's actually considered, someone who has added significantly to this whole discussion about Pius. Let me read one more thing from the book, and then I'll take your questions. One of the fun parts of this book was writing about papal trips. I think I could have written a whole book about traveling with the Pope, Boys on the Bus. As crazy as the Vatican sometimes is, and as funny, it gets even crazier and funnier when you go traveling to foreign countries with the Pope. This particular trip was to southern Africa, and it was with John Paul II. We were all happy to leave Lesotho and roll into Swaziland, where the Pope was to say Mass in a soccer stadium. It was a splendid sunlit day, and at the stadium, I strolled through a crowd that seemed more curious than devout. Over near the papal altar, I spied Father Roberto Tucci frowning. Tucci, a gregarious prelate in charge of organizing these trips, was a favorite of Vatican journalists. No one would have guessed he was a Jesuit. He had a down-to-earth style of talking and a bluntness that had occasionally gotten him in trouble with the Vatican's diplomats. He seemed to lack the discretion that made most Vatican officials such bad interviews. When Tucci met the press, often on a smoke break during papal ceremonies, he actually told them what was on his mind, a dangerous practice. I walked over and chatted with him and soon learned the cause of his consternation. The Mass was ready to begin, but the Vatican was waiting for Swaziland's 20-year-old king, Maswati III, who had a habit of arriving late. As Tucci glanced at his watch, a government official in a dark suit approached us. "Coming a bit late is considered a sign of respect in our country," he explained. Tucci said nothing. His eyebrows heaved in exasperation. He badly needed a cigarette. By now, the king was 15 minutes late, and the pope was at the altar, waiting. Tucci surveyed the scene, saw something he didn't like, and spoke into a walkie-talkie. "The heavily armed soldiers," he said, "were too close to the altar, and a machine gun nest was visible behind the pope. That had to be moved, or the mass would look like a military exercise." The pope began celebrating the liturgy, and a few minutes later, a cheer went up. King Maswati had finally arrived, riding along the stadium track in a vintage Cadillac toward his seat of honor. I watched Tucci grumble into his walkie-talkie and shake his head. "Get a load of this," he muttered. I looked up and saw the young king was accompanied by two of his four wives. Polygamy is widespread in Swaziland, and King Maswati always made sure he got first connubial dibs among the country's female population. 3 weeks before the pope arrived, Swaziland had held its annual reed dance, in which tens of thousands of young virgins gather to dance bare-breasted, twirl reeds, and sing in an effort to be noticed by the king, who chooses a new bride from among them. For the girls, selection as the king's latest wife is a unique chance to escape poverty, or at least that was the line I got from Swazi officials at the mass. They also explained that it wasn't as easy as it looks to pick a bride from 20,000 girls dancing in a field. This year, the king, not wanting to rely on first impressions, had videotaped the dance and made his decision afterward. In a bit of irony that probably went right past everyone in attendance, the pope's sermon at the stadium mass defended Christian marriage and sharply criticized polygamy, saying it was disrespectful to women. If the king and his wives were offended, they did not show it. And that kind of thing happened with some regularity on papal trips. So, you know, sometimes a pope can make a deep impression on a country. Sometimes it seems to go right over people's heads. Anyway, I'll stop there, take your questions, and questions about any and all. Sure. Yes, starting over here. Right. You want to know how the Vatican is organized. Is it organized like a corporation might be organized, yes, or is it organized in some other way? And the answer is some other very strange way. The Vatican has grown up, its bureaucracy has grown by accretion, as almost everything at the Vatican has grown. Its architecture has grown the same way. Its art has grown the same way. You know, offices that were founded hundreds of years ago may still exist, but they may share a function with some newer office that, say, was formed after the Second Vatican Council. So the bureaucracy is very sprawling, it's very uncoordinated, and there's very little cross-communication, which was the big thing that I discovered as a journalist. You know, you expect it to be a top-down organization, the Pope at the top of the pyramid, and other offices, more important ones, but communicating with each other in some way. Well, they don't. They don't have weekly cabinet-style meetings. They don't have monthly cabinet-style meetings. They just don't have that kind of thing. Once in a great while, the Pope will call together heads of his major departments, but, you know, not often enough to really make an impact. And as a result, the Vatican's bureaucracy is really a kind of mosaic of fiefdoms, each one protecting its own turf, which is why reform is resisted so strongly. It's very difficult to reform agencies that really don't see themselves as working in cooperation and coordination with each other. Yes?
Can you tell us more about the Curia and their role and think about them?
you'd like to know more about the Roman Curia. Well,
in brief,
the Roman Curia, in theory, exists solely as an extension of the Pope's ministry. In other words, the Roman Curia itself, and Curia officials would tell you this, has no power. They're simply at the service of the Pope. But the fact is the Roman Curia and its offices have become quite entrenched, and you see offices and even individuals seemingly hanging on to power even as popes may change. And so I think that was one of the big complaints when cardinals came to Rome ahead of this conclave, was that they saw the Roman Curia as no longer simply serving the Pope, but acting as a kind of barrier between them and the bishops of the world and the Pope. It seemed to me, or it seemed to a lot of us following this discussion, even though these discussions were secret ahead of the conclave, that the cardinals were upset and were saying so, which was different. They were upset that basically they were dealing more with Roman Curia officials than they were with the Pope, and that it seemed like to get a papal audience, you really needed a miracle almost. So the Roman Curia has greatly expanded, especially over the last 50 years. I expect that under Pope Francis, we're going to see a reduction, a shrinkage, and a simplification. That would be a great accomplishment if he pulls it off. He's going to need some help because, as I say, there's going to be a lot of resistance to this, but he has already shown signs that that's what he wants to do. Yes? Where can you learn Latin? Well, I'm not sure. Locally, where you can learn Latin. Where I learned Latin was in Rome. Maybe you should move to Rome. But if you do, you won't find Father Foster anymore because he's moved back to Milwaukee. Sure. I'd be happy to give you plane fare. No, I think there must be ways of learning Latin that from Denver that I'm not aware of. But I strongly encourage everyone to learn Latin. I encourage my own children to learn Latin, and they did, but only because they lived in Italy, where it was still taught in the major schools. Right, I remember those prayers at the foot of the altar as well. I learned them in Latin, and I was great at reciting them in Latin. I had no idea what they meant until the English language mass came in. And, you know, when I read the English, I thought, oh, that sounded better in Latin to me. But I'm partial to Latin. I love the beauty of Latin. I love the sound of it.
I have one more question.
Yeah. Yes. English 090. I can't say what's in that class. The question is whether journalists, I guess, have to have special training nowadays. When I was in college, I was an English major. I felt that equipped me to do anything in life. And sure enough, it did, right? Nowadays, journalists are told they have to go to journalism school, and when they get out, they're told there really aren't many jobs out here for you. So I'm not sure if it still doesn't make sense to be an English major. Somebody over here had a... Yes, sorry.
Do the current economic problems in Italy affect the Vatican?
Well, yes and no. The Vatican, of course, operates as a state. When the question is whether economic problems in Italy affect the Vatican. I would say economic problems worldwide affect the Vatican, mainly because the Vatican is living off a kind of allowance that came into effect in 1929. I don't want to give you too much history, but Italy is a fairly young country, and when the Papal States were dissolved 150 years ago, there was a big problem because you know, the Vatican didn't go along with the establishment of a free and independent Italian state. Well, they resolved that issue with a treaty in 1929. And basically, the Italian government paid off the Vatican for the properties that it was now officially confiscating, leaving the Vatican with this 109 acres of Vatican City. Well, they paid the Vatican substantially. I can't tell you exactly how much, but it was in the billions of dollars in modern currency. So the Vatican's been basically living off its investment of that money since then. The problem is that about 20 or 30 years ago, the income couldn't keep up with expenses. And so what you have is the Vatican very precariously kind of going from year to year on its annual budget. If, for example, they've invested heavily in dollars and the dollar goes way down, they lose big time. Or likewise with euros. They have to be very careful about where they're putting their money. And I often tell people that the Vatican is not as wealthy as it seems. They operate on its annual budget is about $330 million. Okay? That is not that much when you think of it. That's less than, you know, most U.S. major universities, for example. And they have more than 4,000 active employees. So they're paying a big payroll on that as well. And they live basically on the generosity of people around the world who give every year. And the number one donor? United States. Followed by Germany. Yes?
So you wrote your book and finished it before all this recent news. Do you have any other thoughts about what we might be seeing with the new Pope?
Right. The question is whether I see changes ahead under the new Pope. Yes, I do. I've already seen some changes, and I think there's the promise of more. You know, from the very beginning, this new Pope did some kind of minor symbolic things that nevertheless sent a message. You know, he did not put on the ermine cape when he went out to greet the crowd right after his election. He did not put on this big gold pectoral cross they wanted to hang on him. These are very minor things, but they do send a message. He took the bus with the rest of the cardinals back to his residence instead of getting in the papal limousine. More importantly, he has continued to live at the Vatican's guest house instead of moving into the papal apartments. This is very significant because when you're in the papal apartments, you are basically surrounded by officials and offices of the Roman Curia. It's a buffer zone. It keeps people away. You can't just walk in without an appointment, and that means going through papal aides. Where he's living, he sees people all the time, people who come into the guest house who are guests there. Not just anybody can walk in, but he is celebrating Mass every morning, kind of a low-key Mass, to any Vatican employee or other people who may want to come in, and giving these very short, pithy sermons. He's acting as a pastor, and he's doing it away from what has traditionally been the nerve center of the Roman Curia. This, I think, worries people at the highest levels of the Vatican bureaucracy. And, of course, he went out and kissed the feet of young inmates at the prison on Holy Thursday. This was another break with tradition. Previously, popes had kissed the feet of 12 priests. Okay, well, suddenly he was kissing the feet of 12 young inmates, including two women. So, yeah, there were gasps heard about that. He named a group of eight cardinals to help him reform the Roman Curia. That's going to be an ongoing project. They're going to talk about governance of the church and reform of the Curia. I think this showed that he was very serious about this project. He named eight cardinals, seven of them from outside the Vatican. So, yes, I think we'll see big changes. And he's also said things. A lot of things he's impressed people with are gestures. But among the things he's said so far, one has struck me as particularly important. And that is, he said that hypocrisy undermines the church's credibility. That if Catholics, and including people at the top, are not seen as actually living out the gospel, people aren't going to follow them. And that seems to me to be the crux of evangelization in the modern age. Yeah. The question is whether I spent any any leisure time with John Paul II, and what is my evaluation of him? Well, I wouldn't exactly call it leisure time. I have spoken to him, you know, not really at length, basically in meetings that we've had over the years, but they've been group meetings where I'm acting mainly as a journalist. John Paul II used to give press conferences on his plane, in which he would actually walk around in the coach section of the plane, which is where we journalists were, and take our questions. And he would sometimes spend, you know, a half hour taking questions. So you could get him engaged in a conversation. And so on occasion, I did that. Beyond that, no, you know, I think he knew who I was, and I sure knew who he was. He was a very impressive man. I think he did more to build bridges to the outside world than any figure in the last several hundred years. And I think the reason is that because he actually lived outside the church's borders as a young man for many years. You know, he was a university student. He was an actor. He had a girlfriend, apparently. He was a worker in a factory. He knew what it was like to be, you know, living in the real world. And I don't say this to in any way criticize Pope Benedict, but Pope Benedict, and I make this point in my book, really knew the Catholic Church very well, but that was the only world he knew as a young man. He went into the seminary at, I think, age 11, and except for a brief stint as a draftee in the army, that was his world from then on. And I think for that reason, Benedict had a lot more problems connecting with people outside the church. I think Benedict was very good at describing the beauty of the faith for someone who's in the church, but maybe a little less able to reach people who have drifted away or who never have shown any interest. Yes?
My question is, first, you're the second Vatican expert to be here this week in Denver, as Cardinal Jewish was here. Speculation was towards the end of John Paul II's life that Jewish really ran, you know, the internal and spoke in the name of the Pope, especially with those last of the appointments towards as he was dying. With Pope Benedict, has Archbishop Gainswein also kind of had that similar role in kind of governing a little more than Pope Benedict?
Right. You're asking about the role of papal secretaries and how powerful they can be. Cardinal Jivich, who was then Monsignor Jivich with John Paul II, and Monsignor Ganswein with Benedict. Well, I think certainly because John Paul II lingered on with a grave illness for many years, yes, I would agree that Monsignor Jivich's role grew over the years, and he became really the gatekeeper. And I think in some ways, of course, you could say this was necessary. He was protecting the Pope's health, and he was protecting the Pope's schedule, really, is what he was protecting. Nevertheless, it left some people feeling like, you know, it's Pope Jivich. And they were not that happy about it. I think with Archbishop Ganswein, it was different, mainly because Pope Benedict did not reach the point of having to need someone who acted as a complete gatekeeper. Now, keep in mind, Benedict never saw that many people anyway. John Paul II used to invite people to his lunch table almost every day and converse with them. That was a channel of communication for him that was very important. Benedict never did that. He did not have an interest in doing that. He wanted to protect some of his private life And I can understand that. But, you know, as a result, the gatekeeping began almost, in a sense, from day one with Pope Benedict. So there wasn't really any change. Yes?
Is there any talk about John the 23rd? What's the view of him having been sort of a temporary stable for a long time?
Right. The question is about the role of Pope John the 23rd. Well, there has been talk about John the 23rd recently because we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Second Vatican Council. And, you know, John the 23rd was expected to be just an interim pope, an older man who would, you know, not do anything revolutionary. Well, that's what happens when you put too many expectations on a pope. And, of course, he has been beatified. And I think, you know, he's remembered quite lovingly by people, certainly in Italy, and probably people in many other countries. You know, it's not that at the Vatican people are talking about him every day. I mean, it's funny. At the Vatican, you know, when a pope has gone, there's a certain tendency to turn the page and not to linger too much sentimentally over figures. But there is, I think, some great sentiment toward John the 23rd among just the average faithful. Yes?
I've heard the Pope referred to as the absolute monarch. And in practice, is that true? I mean, does the Pope do exactly what he wants to do without
Right. Is the Pope really an absolute monarch? Can he do whatever he wants to do? Well, in theory, yes. But in practice, that's very hard to do. You would find, you know, the Pope is sometimes described as the supreme legislator. He can rewrite church law. He can make changes on his own. He can do whatever he feels is necessary for the governance of the church. But I don't think you're going to see a pope in this day and age do things strictly on his own because, you know, we expect, not only here in the United States, but in most countries, expect some kind of consensus to be built before even a pope makes a major move. So I think, for example, that's why Pope Francis named these eight cardinals. He could have taken out his pen and rewritten the way he wanted to, a reform of the Roman Curia. But I think he definitely wants this to be seen as a movement not only of his own authority, but of a greater sentiment throughout the church. So I guess that answers your question, right? One last question? Okay.
This is multifaceted.
I'll brace myself.
Number one, I would like your comments on Colorado's Cardinal Stafford, what do you think of what the Pope has just recently done about the United States nuns, and finally, kind of, has your book been reviewed in the National Catholic Reporter?
Well, I'll answer the last one first because that's the easiest. Yes, it has been reviewed in the National Catholic Reporter. And they reviewed it very kindly. As far as Cardinal Stafford goes, you know, I can't really give you a judgment on him. We dealt with him, of course, when he was at the Vatican. I don't know how he was here as Archbishop. He certainly brought John Paul to Denver in a big way and put Denver on the map in that sense. So I think at the Vatican he was seen as a very intellectual figure. I'm not sure that in the end his impact was tremendous, but you know it's very hard to say. He was in offices where the impact is hard to read. Number one. As for the U.S. nuns, the question about the Vatican's dealing with the American nuns, that's a complex question too. The other day we had news that the Vatican issued a statement saying that basically the judgment against the U.S. nuns remains. Well, I think this was a way for the doctrinal congregation at the Vatican to kind of go on record as saying, Just because we have a new pope doesn't mean that this whole issue has been forgotten. As we know, the Vatican has been critical of the leadership of U.S. nuns here and has suggested some pretty major changes in direction. And those changes remain to be worked out. I think we're going to see in the future how the new pope feels about this. I don't think that Vatican statement the other day reflected the thoughts of Pope Francis necessarily. I also think it would have been unimaginable, really, to have expected the new pope to have suddenly undone what had been done over the last two or three years regarding the U.S. nuns. You can't undo an apostolic visitation. You have to somehow deal with the consequences. But, you know, I think we'll see over the next year or two whether this issue is simply going to go dormant a bit or whether there, in fact, are some new battles ahead.
Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.